Welcome to Endo Battery, where I share about my endometriosis and adenomyosis story and continue learning along the way. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice or diagnosis, but a place to equip you with information and a sense of community, ensuring you never have to face this journey alone. Join me as I navigate the ups and downs and share stories of strength, resilience, and hope while navigating the world of endometriosis and adenomyosis from personal experience to expert insights. I'm your host, Alana, and this is Endo Battery, charging our lives when endometriosis drains us. Welcome back to Endo Battery. Grab your cup of coffee or your cup of tea and join me at the table. I'm joined at the table today by Dr. Naomi Whitaker, who is the founder of RRM Academy and is an OBGYN fertility surgeon focused on women's restorative reproductive medicine, compassionate healthcare, and education. Dr. Whitaker is a board-certified OBGYN and a fellowship-trained surgeon who specializes in the Creighton Model Fertility Care System and NAPRO technology, which works cooperatively with women's body to treat the underlying cause of gynecologic issues and infertility, such as endometriosis and PCOS. Dr. Whitaker helps women improve their gynecologic health and avoid or achieve pregnancy in accordance with their natural fertility using the latest research, medicine, and surgery. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Naomi Whitaker. Thank you, Dr. Whitaker, for joining us today and taking your time out of your busy schedule to join me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, you're welcome. I do want to start off this episode by saying that what we're going to talk about today can be triggering for a lot of people. This is not an easy topic to talk about. And especially if you are in the trenches of walking through fertility issues or infertility issues, or if you've had your fertility stripped from you in the past and are unable to have kids. So this may be triggering to you. And I just want to say that I hear you and I see you, and I want you to know that you are not in any way, shape, or form looked over. And this can be hard, but this can be triggering for some. And I just want to say that. But I do think it's important that we do talk about it, because a lot of people do struggle in this area specifically. So thank you for being the person to talk about this in such a great and delicate way.
Yeah, it's such an important topic. And I'm so glad that you're bringing this information out there.
Yeah. Can you explain to us what it is that you do, as far as what the difference is between what you do and what a typical GYN would do or typical specialty in fertility would do? Can you kind of give us a background of what it is that you specialize in?
Sure. So it's its own type of approach where it's not quite it dabbles in minimally invasive gynecologic surgery. It's somewhere in between minimally invasive gynecologic surgery and REI.
It's a
combination of both of those. So, but I don't do IVF. I actually use surgery to treat underlying women's health issues, for example. Also, I use bioidentical hormones and cycle charting, and I combine all of those together to help boost natural fertility, timing intercourse instead of IUI, big endo surgeries, tubal corrective surgeries instead of IVF. That's kind of my version. Okay. So women come to me who either failed IVF, IUI, or don't want to do that approach, or they're coming to me before they're actively trying to conceive and they see issues. Either they were cycle charting and they saw issues, or they're very knowledgeable either from a family member or a friend that told them something isn't right. And so they're coming to me younger in hopes that maybe one day they can preserve their fertility, maybe even enhance their fertility so that they can be ready when the time is right to try to conceive.
Mm-hmm. Do you have patients that walk into your door that don't know that they have maybe an underlying condition or know what the condition is, but they just know that they're struggling with fertility and they maybe aren't as comfortable with IVF, or they've had a reaction to IVF and they're coming to you and they're like, what is going on with me? How often do you see that in your clinic?
I would say most women don't know it's endometriosis, right? Most women don't say this is absolutely endometriosis, where women are told things are normal throughout their whole life, either by their mother or their teachers or their physicians. And so they come, they say something's wrong. Clearly, I'm not getting pregnant and I want an answer.
Right.
And you and I probably know quite quickly that endometriosis is very high on the likelihood, even if only infertility is the problem. But usually when you dig deeper, and I started to do this endometriosis symptom survey to pretty much any woman that walks in with fertility issues. And the main thing that I found so far, I've only been doing it for a few months, is that women underreport their symptoms. They have normalized it to themselves for so long that, you know, they kind of lived with it. They put up with it, or they work their life around it. And then, unfortunately, many of these women, I mean, I definitely have a subset of women that are coming to me mainly for pain, but there's a big subset that put up with so much pain and suffering and don't pursue aggressive options until they're trying to conceive. And that's the one final thing to push them over that line to actually seek treatment.
Yeah. Talking about this survey, I saw that you had recently just posted something on your Instagram account about this survey. Can you tell us a little bit about what this survey entails, what it is aimed to do, so that we can get a better picture of maybe what we can be looking at or what people can be looking at when they're thinking about this in the sense of fertility and endometriosis?
Yeah. So I put together a survey that is just my brain on paper when someone comes to me for a surgical consult. Either they're coming to me for pain or infertility or both. And then I ask them all these questions. And when they say these symptoms, these are the ones that really stand out in my mind as specific to endometriosis. Obviously, it's a whole constellation of symptoms, and you have to take into consideration the big picture. Some symptoms overlap with other issues that could be not related to endometriosis. But I thought, well, if I put my brain on paper, more people will have access to what it's like to be in the mind of a surgeon. Now, obviously, it's not a way to diagnose it. It's just a suspicion score. And so people ask me all the time, what does this score mean? Well, I can't tell you much about it, except when the score is very high, like especially 30 or more, I think that makes it very likely for endometriosis to be there. But if the score is low, like even a score of 7 or 11, I've found people report stage 4 endometriosis even. And of course, symptom score is not correlated to staging.
Right.
That's not surprising, right? And this is all preliminary data. I would love to research it. It's not research. But I think the lower symptoms score doesn't rule it out. But it is something to bring up, like, okay, well, you know which symptoms to focus on when you go to a provider. See if they even, if you are screening a surgeon, do they even take these symptoms seriously? You know, so that's something to consider as well. So I felt like it was a way to bring access to people who may not be able to see a surgeon like myself. You know, I only see patients in Pennsylvania and those in Virginia. So I know access is a huge problem. And so, and for me, you know, I have endometriosis. I didn't realize these are symptoms until fellowship.
Interesting.
And so even me in the field of OBGYN, I didn't even realize these symptoms are highly suggestive of endometriosis.
Which, I mean, I think that's true with a lot of us, right? We don't put our symptoms together. And even after my diagnosis and after my surgeries, there were symptoms that I had that I didn't put together with my endometriosis until after. And it was more because I was learning about these symptoms and how it correlated with the endometriosis. For instance, I didn't really realize my UTIs that weren't really UTIs were probably endometriosis, right? So there's all these little tidbits of information our body gives us that we aren't necessarily putting our pieces together. And I would even say this is post-operatively symptoms. And I'm like, okay, could this have been because of endometriosis, or is this in correlation to because I've had it for so many years? And so I think that's true with a lot of us that struggle with endometriosis. Are you able to speak on the success rate for those patients that maybe have adenomyosis? Because this is a big one for us in the endometriosis community, as far as a lot of us that are struggling with fertility not only have endometriosis, but have adenomyosis as well. Is that something that you kind of deal with on a daily basis as part of helping those achieve success in fertility?
Absolutely. So I had to really do my own research on adenomyosis, because there's really not good information out there. So mm-hmm. there's technically two different types of adenomyosis. There's diffuse and there's focal.
Right.
So diffuse is more common in women who have had children and does not cause infertility, but can cause the symptoms like fullness, heavy bleeding. But the good thing is that shouldn't really affect fertility. It's very often visualized on ultrasound. In an article that I read, analyzing many, many studies and summarizing the findings, it compared it to the boy who cried wolf. So mm-hmm. adenomyosis is overcalled on ultrasound because obviously we know endometriosis is missed more often than not by ultrasound and MRI, but they might see some junctional changes or whatever, the ultrasound findings, or an enlarged uterus. Mm-hmm. So, oh, it must be that, right? Just because you find it doesn't mean it's clinically significant. And now that our ultrasound technology is more clear than it used to be, we're finding it more and now we're overcalling it based on what I've been able to find and what I see clinically. I see it frequently and I don't see other signs of issues if it's just that, for example.
Right.
And I don't consider that in my... Other than management of symptoms, I don't consider that as a barrier to conceiving.
Okay.
Now, it's very different. Someone messaged me today. They have a 7-centimeter adenomyoma. Now, mm-hmm. that's very different. That's evidence of focal adenomyosis. So a big nodule or area of endometriosis growing into the muscle of the uterus. And so those do cause infertility. But the good thing is those are resectable. You just treat it very similarly to endometriosis. Mm-hmm.
And does
that? It's definitely trickier surgically, right. But.
And from my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but doing those does increase risk sometimes with fertility, depending on who you see. Like you wouldn't want to see just anyone to see.
No matter what.
Right.
Period. If you are interested in fertility, and I think that's something I really want to bring out today into light, is that who your surgeon is matters mm-hmm. more than anything, right? Because not only finding it all, but tissue handling, being very delicate with tissue. I see people on social media even just grabbing the fallopian tubes. You don't want to do that with these very strong instruments. Obviously, you don't want to take out fallopian tubes without right. patient consent, which obviously happens a lot. I'm sure you've gotten those messages like I have. I went under anesthesia. I woke up without a fallopian tube. I've seen it on patients who go to surgeons. They go there for fertility. The tube is taken out because they thought it was endometriosis. Pathology was negative. For endometriosis on the tube. They took out the whole tube. So surgeon choice matters. Someone who's fertility friendly, who really respects that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot to it. We could definitely go into it more. That's touching the surface of it. But number one, respecting autonomy, respecting that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I have patients all the time. Are you going to take out my tube? Are you going to take out my ovary? I mean, you know, and I explain how often I do that, which is almost never, mm-hmm. unless I think it looks like there's a cancer. I pretty much try to save every fallopian tube or ovary after, you know, informed discussion with a patient, of course.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are exceptions in women who aren't trying to conceive population.
Yeah. If someone comes into your office and they've already had excision surgery, but they are still struggling with fertility or even sometimes probably pain, what are some approaches that you take to help them achieve their ultimate goal of either fertility or pain relief?
Yeah. So of course I look back at their operative report to see what was done. And I go over with them concerns from what was seen, including, you know, the potential or of adhesions, or if they did appropriate adhesion prevention. If they checked the tubes with chromoperturbation, they may have missed a partial occlusion of the fallopian tubes, which is pretty common with endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And so for that, I do a selective hysterosalpingogram, which is more accurate than a regular hysterosalpingogram. It's where the x-ray is put above the body.
Okay.
And I have an actual cannula that goes into the fallopian tube. And I have a pressure gauge and it measures if there's a partial occlusion. So I don't want to just see spillage of dye. I also want to see that the pressure is very low. And so that indicates the tube is wide open.
Okay.
And so I check each tube individually. And then if there's a partial or complete occlusion, I have a guide wire that I can run down the tube, kind of like snaking a sink to open it up. I just see tubal occlusion with endometriosis, period.
Okay.
More like, or with infertility, period. You know, I'm not sure what the risk factors are, if it's congenital, Mm-hmm. You know, hereditary, someone's born with it. If there's endometriosis in the tube, if there's debris in the tube or inflammation related to endometriosis, or if it's just infertility as a symptom. It's hard to say, but I do screen almost all women that come to me who are undergoing surgery. I offer them that because if they haven't tried to conceive, it's going to be silent. And then they're at increased risk, in my opinion, if they likely have endometriosis. I do think many times it is probably congenital and treatable, and it goes away mm-hmm. after that procedure. But I like to offer it to most women undergoing surgery, even if they're not actively trying to conceive, because I've had women come to me with endometriosis, they got excision, they got a lot better, and then they come back to me with infertility because their tubes were occluded. And if we had just checked it when they were focused on the pain, but they knew they wanted children later, I regretted not offering it earlier. I explained, hey, if you haven't been trying, you may not want to do this procedure, but I like to just offer it if they're going under general anyway.
Right.
Because it's pretty quick. It's very quick.
Well, and it sounds like it's a more proactive approach as opposed to a reactive approach, which we all know that when you're reactive, that's when things can get a little hairy with outcomes. And so sometimes it's better to be proactive when it comes to things like this, specifically for fertility.
Yeah, I think it depends on the woman and what her desires are and where she is. And, mm-hmm. you know, some women really want to be on top of it, want to be ahead of it and be proactive. And that gives them peace of mind, and others want to take it as it comes. So, yeah.
And I think, some people are just in survival mode, and so they aren't thinking.
And that too. Yeah. So when I bring it up, they're like, what are you talking about? Sometimes they're really blindsided by it. Like, why are we talking about this? Like, well, because I deal with so much infertility, it's always on my mind. So I want to bring it up, I say. And if you don't want it, that's fine. Because it is another intervention that may be unnecessary. So,
yeah.
Other things you want me, I can tell you that I see that are really unknown with endometriosis include, well, inflammation in the uterus, which could be related directly to endometriosis, and sometimes chronic endometritis, which means inflammation in the uterus from infection. And then, of course, polyps as well. It's important. I like to look for polyps in everyone and biopsy everyone and look with a camera for anyone with abnormal bleeding and or pain, if they're going under surgery anyway, because it's, again, quick and you can improve outcomes, because it's rare that I don't find endometriosis at surgery. But if that is the case, then I usually find something else. So a common thing that I'll find is an infection in the uterus. So it can exacerbate endometriosis pain or infertility. Or it could be the main cause of pain for some women. That's rare, but I have had that maybe one case a year where I'm expecting endometriosis, I don't find it. And in those cases, I usually find something else, like an infection in the uterus, like E. coli, which shouldn't be there. And again, that not only will help her outcome of pain but and abnormal bleeding, but also prevents infertility down the road, because like the one I'm thinking of was a teenager. I don't know how it gets in there, but it probably is related to immune system dysfunction. We don't really know. It's not due to lack of hygiene or STDs. You know, that's a common question, but that's an easy thing to do at the time of surgery is get some swabs, check for infection. And I do get probably a lot more swabs than maybe needed because I'm covering for infertility as well. But I typically get aerobic, anaerobic, mycoplasma, ureaplasma, fungal, viral. We get 10 swabs, but that covers most of them.
Interesting. Do you think that more doctors should be looking for things like that when patients come in? I mean, I think maybe across the board, but specifically for those who are going in for excision surgery, do you think that we need to take more of those samples and swabs to be able to really identify if there's more going on than what you initially thought, more than just endometriosis?
Yeah, I rarely just find endometriosis. Typically, you know, you have your pre-op and post-op diagnosis. My post-op diagnosis is very long. It's usually 4 or 5 lines, not just different areas of endometriosis, but evidence of inflammation or polyps or cervical stenosis or tubal stenosis, adhesions. I look at the liver, you know, and I see if there's inflammation of the liver or fatty liver. So I tried to do a whole assessment of everything that I see for health purposes. Because as you know, women with endometriosis or pelvic pain or infertility, they're all very complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's usually not just one thing going on, especially by the time they present 10 years later after they've been asking for help. Things have usually gotten pretty bad.
Yeah. And I'm sure the immune response portion of that is often overlooked because it's not always a definitive picture right out of the gate where people aren't just thinking, oh, there's an immune response to this. It's, oh, there's endometriosis. Let's go get the endometriosis. But there's, you know, I think maybe that could be another key as to why some of us struggle so much postoperatively as well, is maybe we're missing that piece.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm always learning more about the immune system, about mast cell response. I don't know much about that. I was not taught about that at all. Mm. And that's clearly an issue.
Yeah.
Tons of rashes postoperatively. That's the most, by far the most common complication, significant rashes, not just a little bit, but many women react to something, whether it's the glue, whether it's the prep, it's very common. Mm-hmm. So clearly there's a lot more that we need to be doing that I don't know about. But I'm always trying to learn. That's why I like being on social media, because I'm always learning from followers who are telling me about their experiences, what helped them. And I try to share their raw, authentic experiences, because you know that's how we're going to advance.
Yeah. Well, and who better to learn from sometimes than the patients? Because, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, what I see a lot of times is doctors get really stuck in what they know, but it's because that's where it's comfortable. That's where they excel. They understand it. But sometimes what the patient is telling you contradicts what you know. And so if you're not learning and growing from the patient, sometimes you become stagnant in your care. And I would say, like, a lot of really good surgeons aren't that way, and they do listen to their patients. So that's kind of is a generalization and not completely for everyone. But I do see that happen quite often where I'm really good at this one area as a doctor, but the patient is telling you something completely different than what you know. And so that can be, I think, uncomfortable for doctors. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but maybe you have had that experience at times where you're like, this is not what I'm familiar with. But to hear the patient out sometimes and kind of like suss it out and see, okay, is there validity to this? Are we, you know, is this something I need to look at even further? Maybe our quality of care would even increase if patients spoke honestly and openly to doctors about these scenarios.
Yeah, I think, and there's a couple things contributing to that. I mean, number one, as a surgeon and a physician, we need to be in control of the situation as much as possible. That's how we have safe and good outcomes.
Right.
And so we need to be in charge of the operating room. We need to be in charge of the labor and delivery room if we're doing obstetrics. And part of that includes a confidence in our knowledge to be able to be in control. But on the other hand, with endometriosis, there is some humility that it takes to be good at what you do. Because endometriosis will constantly humble you. You cannot predict where it will be. It'll go on an organ in a new way every time. No two cases are the same. Mm-hmm. And so, especially in the beginning of your career, when you have no idea what you're going to encounter next, it's very scary. That's one thing you learn with endometriosis. And I tell patients that all the time.
Yeah,
I wish I could tell you if you're stage one or stage four or what organs are involved. But that's one of the hardest things about endometriosis is I can't really predict your case when I'm seeing you for a surgical consult.
And
so there's a balance there.
Yeah.
Of trying to handle that growth and humility and confidence together. There is a way to do it, but that's not something that can really be taught, right?
So I do think patients appreciate when doctors sit there and say, that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about that. And it feels validating to the patient to hear a doctor say, you know, that's a really good point, because they're so used to being dismissed a lot of times, specifically when it comes to endometriosis and probably infertility issues. They're so used to being dismissed, or, you know, doctors aren't sure what to do. So they just kind of, you know, move them on along. I can't help you anymore. So when a doctor is learning more or willing to learn more and say, you know, that's a really interesting point of view, I really appreciate that perspective, there might be something to that. And so thank you for taking that time to listen and hear the patients and hear the people who have walked through this day in and day out and are struggling, because sometimes that can be the most healing, for sure.
Yeah. I also have been on the end of being dismissed even recently when my husband needed back surgery. I had researched the advancements of back surgery and the history of it for 10 years before we decided to move forward with a more invasive option for my husband. And we went to someone local, which I was pretty confident we probably weren't going to go with, but it was one of those things you need to do that step before you go out of network, because I was hoping to maybe get the more advanced treatment covered. It was kind of like the excision of back surgeries, you know?
Yeah.
The excision version of surgery for, I mean, if you had to compare it to endometriosis. And so it's hard to find someone that does that kind of care. And in some ways, I knew more about the advancements of spine surgery than the surgeon. And he was so off put by that. It didn't go very well. You know,
yeah.
It would have been just really good for him to say, he actually called the next day and apologized.
Wow.
Not directly about the way he approached it, but I agree. I mean, I don't think physicians realize that, because they think the perspective of a physician is, if we admit our weakness, you're going to lose trust in us.
Right?
Like, I think that's part of it. And so it's that confidence that you want to bring. But again, physicians sometimes forget what it's like as a patient to live with the disease. It's very different than to treat a disease.
Yeah.
And that patient experience is very unique, and you can't outdo that with clinical experience.
Yeah.
You can't. Yeah. And the mode that you get in when your life has been completely changed by a horrible disease, the motivation and the hours and the commitment to reading and learning and understanding is just so different than someone who's doing surgery.
Yeah. It's so true. And I think, but it's also good for the patients to hear that perspective too, because we can get stuck in our journey and not see the perspective of the doctor sometimes, of like, I don't think they intended to hurt you. I think they just didn't understand. And so we can compartmentalize that, and we can internalize that, and it can affect how we navigate our future care. And so I think that's kind of a twofold thing, right? It just as much as we want the doctors to continue learning and to continue growing as patients, it's valuable for us to be able to do the same and have better understanding of our providers. And if something doesn't sound right, ask the question. Like, I don't know a provider that is a good provider that won't sit there and answer your questions. If it's a bad provider, they may not want to answer your questions. So that may not be the doctor for you. But I do think that it's a relationship, and you have to foster that relationship responsibly and with integrity on both sides. And I think that if we do that, then the partnership gets stronger. I mean, that's just my take on that.
Yeah. And the surgeon, not to knock on this surgeon, I think he meant well. I do. I think he's a very good doctor, but his toolkit is different than what I needed and what I was asking for. And so I got him out of his comfort zone, and then he wasn't used to that. And so I don't think he knew how to handle that. I don't think it was anything personal against me or my husband. And I think he meant well. And I actually know he's a very good surgeon from people I work with who've worked with him in the operating room. He's very respectful to staff. So it's a complicated topic. You know, it's complicated. Again, doesn't mean that's like it's personal or that they're a bad doctor,
but
it's a place that we need to grow.
Yeah. But I think that just as to say is like, we're always continuing to grow in our knowledge and understanding of endometriosis, surgical technique, approaches. And I think what's interesting is, you know, I went to the endometriosis summit, and this is part of the endometriosis summit is they have these panels, and they kind of debate this. And it's interesting to see that even some of the top excision specialists in the world are learning from other doctors that walk into the room, because they're having this, I wouldn't even call it a debate necessarily, but I would say a discussion on different techniques and different approaches. And it's all keeping in mind the patient outcome. And if you can find a provider that has the patient outcome in mind, I think you have a better chance.
I think the key is patient-driven, patient-centered. I think you nailed it right there. And truly patient-centered, mm-hmm. which is hard to know sometimes when you don't, for example, if a surgeon doesn't understand excision is the best, right? Then mm-hmm. how do they even understand what's best for the patient outcome?
That's a challenge.
Yeah,
that's a whole nother topic. We could probably talk for hours on that topic.
But if you want me to get into a few other things
sure.
that go wrong yeah. with endometriosis, you know, for if a woman comes to me and her main issue is endometriosis, even if it's advanced stage, I mean, she has a very high likelihood of success mm-hmm. when you do thorough excision surgery, find it all. Even a bowel resection, it really improves fertility rates when needed. And then adhesion prevention, especially with advanced disease. But unfortunately, these women often have a lot of other issues going on, especially if they tend to have other risk factors, like if they're older, if they've had a lot of abnormal bleeding, if they are married to like a man with severe male factor. Mm. And so that's what I talk about in my discussion with these patients. First, we do need to find answers. So mm-hmm. endometriosis is exciting to find because it's a big answer. And then it's a big process to get overcome that. Outcomes are really good, especially if that's your main thing. But it's important that we look at everything, including do they have an ovulation defect? So we screen for women who have ovulation defects. And so that means the follicle doesn't grow and collapse. The key is to watch it collapse as well and rupture to make sure that they're actually ovulating and releasing an egg, because there are conditions that make it look like she's ovulating, but she's not really. Mm-hmm. And so we do an ultrasound series to confirm that she's actually ovulating. Ovulation defects where they don't actually collapse the follicle, called luteinized unruptured follicle syndrome, is increased in women with endometriosis. And again, that can be silent because her hormones can go up and make it look like she ovulated right. after that. Hormone dysfunction, super common, where they have low progesterone, especially very common, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Why they're, especially if they have pain, why they're more symptomatic, or maybe why their disease is more severe, mm-hmm. because they have an imbalanced ratio of estrogen progesterone. Progesterone is anti-inflammatory and likely helps offset the inflammation fueled by estradiol. Other things like insulin resistance are important to optimize, because that's going to worsen inflammation mm-hmm. and fertility issues. Women tend to age their ovaries faster, so have high FSH, may have low DHEA. These are things that are very treatable mm-hmm. most of the time, as long as, you know, we know that. So giving DHEA, kind of fueling this tank, kind of like similar to, I look at it similar to ferritin and low iron, which is also a common issue. You can do a similar thing with hormones to kind of help optimize hormones. If you study that, and you can work with the body to help support the hormone health.
Yeah.
And then we often see low cervical mucus. And so probably related to inflammation, that can be improved with excision sometimes, or other times we do give mucus enhancers, or low dose naltrexone
yeah.
can help with ovarian function for women who are going through quicker aging of the ovaries. Because it helps reduce the autoimmune component, inflammatory component. So women feel better on low-dose naltrexone and their fertility can be improved on that medication. Thyroid fatigue from maybe blamed on endometriosis. There could be thyroid issues.
Yeah.
There could be low iron issues. And then something simple that may be overlooked is just poor timing of intercourse too. Knowing there's one main day of peak fertility the whole month. And so we educate women on that main day. So that's kind of an overview of everything. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than I could probably get into right now, but.
Right. But at least there's a starting point. There's something to look at. It's interesting that the low dose naltrexone is helpful for fertility, because I know a lot of people are starting to use that for like pain and pain response to help our body's systems essentially calm down, because we are always in that fight flight mode, you know? And so a lot of times that will help kind of ease the pain, kind of get us out of that heightened state. So it's interesting that that works for fertility as well. I hadn't heard that before.
Yes, it's phenomenal. Very safe, very effective, very affordable. Mm-hmm. It is compounded though. So
right,
it's not going to be marketed by Big Pharma. In fact, it appears that the research has kind of been suppressed by Big Pharma.
Interesting.
So because the research can't be published in mainstream journals because it is a huge competitor for medications that cost tens of thousands of dollars for Crohn's disease. It's been shown to really improve like kind of remission of symptoms in Crohn's disease and it, for like $30 a month versus $15,000. And so these same drug companies are advertising in the same medical journals that would be otherwise publishing this data. And so they don't like that. They're going to lose their revenue in these journals.
Wow. That is interesting. See, these are the things that as a patient, we wouldn't be privy to without.
No, and it was hard for me to find this out. But yeah, the researcher that was mainly doing all of this, I believe she was at Penn State in Pennsylvania. She had tons of research. She was doing the cutting edge research and she cleaned her website of her research. So I heard from a physician who follows this really closely.
Interesting. That's fascinating. I know that a lot of people in my inner circle have benefited significantly from doing it. And it seems to really help with the pain more than, you know,
yes,
any other drug that they've taken. So
I personally have benefited from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had nerve pain from Lyme disease and it went away in 3 months, which is when the amount of time it takes for it to work optimally is 3 months.
Interesting. Okay. Well, this is a whole nother topic we're going to have to come back to at another time.
Maybe it's not naltrexone. I mean, the risks are mainly vivid dreams is the most common risk. Side effect, I should say.
Yeah.
And then some might have decreased appetite, which can be a problem with women with low BMI, you know, which can happen with endometriosis. So that's something to talk about. But really, you can stop it at any time. If there's an issue, there's no problem with that. We go up slow just to make sure women can adjust, just because women with endometriosis tend to be very sensitive to medications. Mm-hmm. Though you don't have to taper up slowly, but we just tend to do that. It's the most well-tolerated that way.
Interesting. Okay. Something that else that I think would be interesting to understand and know is, do you see a lot of patients that come in that maybe don't have any pain, but are just struggling? Because, you know, we know that with endometriosis specifically, they don't always have pain. And so they go in, but they're just struggling for fertility. And that's how they find they have the endometriosis. Do you see that often or is that not as often as the pain?
I see it pretty often, more often than you would expect, where the pain is less than you would think for the amount of disease that they have. When you finally do look, it's amazing. Yeah. I don't understand. And no, if you talk to any experienced endosurgeon, no one is going to say, I'm super confident in predicting endometriosis stage based on symptoms, because it makes no sense.
It has a mind of its own.
It does. It makes no sense. I've seen some of the worst cases with minimal pain.
Yeah, but I have talked to many people who are like, I didn't have a ton of endo, but my pain was severe.
Absolutely.
And debilitating. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, I was.
Those are the best. Those are the best, right? It's so rewarding.
You're like, oh.
Very straightforward for me.
Yeah. You're like, this was a walk in the park for me today. I love it. So this is just a good reminder that pain doesn't necessarily mean a ton of disease and no pain means no disease. That's why, again, having a specialist on your team makes the biggest difference.
Yeah, just the other week, I had someone that came to me just for dermoid. She said, I had no pain before the dermoid. It's definitely just the dermoid. I have nothing else going on. She scored 7, I think, on the survey, but mainly because of the dermoid, she thought.
Right.
She had very advanced stage 4. And the dermoid was actually mixed in with an endometrioma. It was together. So
interesting.
Luckily, I consented her for it, but I don't think she really mentally was prepared for that diagnosis. And she really wants a family. So
that's so
that was a tricky situation.
Yeah. You had talked a little bit about hormones and the part that they play in your practice. Can you explain that a little bit more and the use that you have for them and how you utilize them?
Sure. One of my favorite treatments hormonally is progesterone. Mm-hmm. What I do is a full hormone profile based on a woman's ovulation. So the reason why most doctors don't do tests is because doctors assume all women ovulate on cycle day 14, and that's maybe 10% of women who actually do that. So you can't really test hormones based on that assumption.
Right.
How to really test hormones is to know when a woman ovulates, which changes on any given cycle, mm-hmm. and be able to, I get hormones 3, 5, 7, 9, and 11 days after that. And I watch the rise and fall of progesterone and estrogen. And I often see a progesterone deficiency, sometimes mm-hmm. in conjunction with estrogen deficiency, sometimes with high estrogen. Frequently with low progesterone, they have a very truncated second half of the menstrual cycle that's pretty frequent. Or premenstrual spotting is another frequent symptom of low progesterone. So cooperatively working with the cycle, giving bioidentical progesterone helps tremendously with bleeding, pain, inflammation, and fertility. It's a very cheap option, and it helps with implantation. You know, if a woman was trying to conceive, it can even help with PMS symptoms. We often see a correlation of hormone fluctuations with the onset of PMS symptoms. So I'm actually doing a study right now based to prove that, because that's not even proven. You would think that basic event of PMS and hormone fluctuation would be a proven correlation, but it's not at all. It's not researched. Mainly because researchers don't really understand the female menstrual cycle, because it's so different between woman to woman and cycle to cycle. And so I'm working with cycle charting and hormone testing that patients would be undergoing anyway, and just correlating that with the survey based on symptoms. And then we're going to treat them and watch them improve. Now, you may know that there's often a progesterone resistance with women with endometriosis. And so for those, we can try going up on more capsules. So we not only treat the numbers, but we treat the symptoms, right? They're both important. And so some women, we need to be more aggressive and get the progesterone shots. Mm-hmm. And I've had women say that that changed their life. I had one, she was thinking about coming back for endosurgery again. She really didn't want to, but she didn't know what else to do. And then we started on progesterone. I said, let's just try these shots. They're not fun, but for women that are suffering, to try these progesterone shots, it, you know, instead of surgery, it's been much less invasive. So she said she had the best period of her life. Her husband noticed, and now she doesn't want to do repeat surgery. I really think it helped me rule out that the recurrence of endometriosis for her, I think. So it's really neat. It's really tailored protocol that we can work with the patient, and then we can check when she's on these hormones to see if she's at a good level. And, you know, this should be very helpful for her whole health of her brain, of her bones, breast tissue. All of that is supported by bioidentical hormones.
That's an interesting, I haven't really heard that before. So that's interesting.
Yeah, we monitor because we don't want estrogen to be super high, and we want the ratio of estrogen progesterone to be in balance, because progesterone should be in a natural setting in the second half of the cycle, very dominant over estrogen. And that technically, I think, has an effect on this next couple weeks. Even so, it's technically, I believe, protective. I have to do more research for the whole cycle. We definitely see improvements in pain and blood flow for the menses after that. But one thing that I do when I review charts and I see women who went through IVF, their estrogen, I never should see it really above, I don't know, 300, and that should be around ovulation, maybe 400 max, just for a day.
Right.
After ovulation, it really shouldn't get much higher than, well, our goal is 120 plus, or, you know, maybe up to 170. I don't like to see it higher. When they don't typically check after stimulation in IVF very often, but when they do, they'll be over 1,000 estrogen.
Wow.
And that terrifies, I've seen it many times. And not to mention, some of these women still have endometriomas, and then they're going to be doing egg retrievals while the estrogen is through the roof. And so they're poking these ovaries and causing bleeding. And so those are the pelvises that I dread going in.
That's a hard discussion to have too. How do you talk to your patients when there are possibilities of not having the outcome that they want? How do you address those?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to be upfront from the beginning. First of all, I'm very optimistic from the get-go. I always try to point at the positive things. But then I also say, no one can ever promise you a baby, right? And I think everyone knows that.
Right.
But, and if anyone says that, or says, if you give me enough money, I'll give you a baby, you know, doctors have said that. I've heard patients have told me that. you know, there are red flags that you should run away from anyone guaranteeing a baby after infertility. But what I do say is at least in the process, you're going to find answers and you're going to find healing. In the end, mm-hmm. you won't be broke. I do take insurance. I know not all endometriosis surgeons are able to do that. So hopefully you won't be broken emotionally, physically, financially. In fact, you should be at least feeling better at the end. And that's one thing we have more control over. We don't have total control of the outcome. Right. And then we also, I try to invite, you know, discussion of being a mother now in other non-biological ways. And there are beautiful mm-hmm. ways of doing that. And so many women have this beautiful calling of volunteering somewhere or whatever their calling is. And I really encourage them to not let infertility rob them of that. So we talk about that and try to really to focus on other ways of being a mother today and not letting infertility rob someone of their life or mm-hmm. bring desperation in, because that's when we get into problems, right? Mm-hmm. Both physically in our health and financially.
And it's interesting that you say that, because I do know there are a lot of people who put a lot of weight into becoming parents. And right, I mean, if you have that desire and that passion to become a parent, it's so deep rooted. And if you're unable to, you grieve, and you grieve hard. And it's a stressor in a relationship. It's a stressor in your mental health, in your emotional health. Do you have a counselor on your staff or people that you refer to through this process?
I wish we would love to have one on staff. So unfortunately, me and my nurses end up doing counseling that we're not qualified to do. We do try to encourage support groups and books and therapists. And we do have people that we do recommend. We would love for someone in our clinic to be there on the premises, because it's so needed. Every single woman facing infertility goes through trauma, like you said. And the problem is it's so drawn out. It's invisible. Women look healthy on the outside and couples. Mm-hmm. And so they feel so alone. Yeah. And just that long grieving process, right? Of your dreams of, mm-hmm. of this life that you envisioned for so many years that maybe no one warned you, mm-hmm. you know, you thought it was guaranteed so many years.
What is your advice to those people who are trying to seek out whether to do IVF or what the next stage of trying for a family should be, if they know that they have endometriosis, or even if they don't know, if they have something that's prohibitive physiologically?
I think everyone deserves answers with going through infertility. The least someone deserves is knowing why. My least favorite diagnosis is obviously unexplained infertility, because that's not really a diagnosis, right? That thing. Well, the doctors gave up, or they stopped, you know, mm-hmm. conventional tests, the basic tests didn't find an answer. So I think knowing why is extremely important for healing mm-hmm. emotionally and physically, right? Because yeah. knowing, for example, I found cancers in patients with infertility. Not, you know, it's not common, but, you know, there are serious issues that lead to infertility. And so someone is worthy to know why. Is it male factor? Is it? And if it's a male factor, he has an increased risk of a shorter life expectancy. Mm. So when there's abnormalities on SFA, it's often a sign of underlying health issues. And so it's a predictor of future health. And so I think it's important to find answers for mm-hmm. emotional and physical healing, first and foremost, and being empowered with what is going on and having a sense of support from each other or faith mm-hmm. or friends or other people going through infertility support groups when navigating these decisions, and not going from that place of desperation, because that's when people yeah. have a reverse mortgage on their house, and then they have no baby and no money, or mm-hmm. no money for adoption. And I had a patient that failed IVF 3 times, and they were like, just do it again. And she was very smart. She and her husband were very, very intelligent. And they were like, why would I repeat the same thing?
Right.
And so they came to me. I said, oh, and she was older too, you know, for trying, you know, like 30, right. late 30s. Or 40. And I said, you know, this is probably endometriosis. And we were going to do a full thorough surgery, and her pre-op labs, she had a positive HCG.
Oh my gosh.
So just through timed intercourse and maybe we did a few little, like maybe hormone support, like a couple yeah. little things, timed intercourse, hormone support. And that's true. 20% of couples that fail IVF will go on to conceive naturally.
Yes.
So clearly, to me, that's proof that too many patients are told to do IVF,
mm-hmm.
right? If 20% conceive naturally, that's proving, that's without any intervention. Imagine how much higher we get that
mm-hmm.
when we actually work and treat endometriosis, treat hormone dysfunction, treat ovulation disorders, improve the seminal fluid analysis. Mm-hmm. And then in the process of, I also help men too, the couple feels better and mm-hmm. and they're excited to feel better. And there are milestones, because often with the long journey of infertility, you don't have a lot of wins, right? Because you're looking right. for the one win of the test that's positive. But what I say is you should look for your biomarkers on your chart to be better, as far as abnormal bleeding, pain, mm-hmm. energy, all of that mm-hmm. should be improving as we're optimizing your health. And so in the end, let's get you feeling better. We're going right. to get there. Bonus if we can have a pregnancy and a healthy pregnancy. Most often they are healthy yeah. when we get them to that point.
Oh, so good to hear for a lot of people. And, you know, and I have heard from other patients who have done IVF and it's affected them negatively with their health. And so I want to encourage people before taking drastic steps to really look at a big picture to consider.
And it's so hard, because just like with endo, if you just mm-hmm. trust your neighborhood OBGYN, you're told you do this, you take this pill, you do this IUI, you do this quick fix.
Right.
And the OBGYN themselves, they mean well. It's not exactly. that. It's not always the best option.
But they don't know what they don't know.
When you look at all the options, they don't. Exactly. It's so different when someone does all their research, right? Because mm-hmm. they may avoid heartache. They get answers. Just being a self-advocate is just so important, you know, and just knowledge and awareness before any decision right. is made. Because the algorithm is, okay, try to conceive for 12 months, random intercourse. If you're not pregnant, next step, ovulation medication for 3 months, which I don't like to give blindly either.
Right.
If someone has an endometrioma, I'm not going to throw high dose ovulation meds. I usually just stop all treatments and say, I really recommend. I mean, it's up to the patient. You know, we talk about risks, but most patients, I don't want them to rupture that, because that if they rupture their endometrioma, that's going to really cause adhesions and long term hurt their success.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about, they're more expedited on the surgical list to talk right. about risk benefits. So we try to avoid ovulation post-peak support is fine, but ovulation medications, we try to avoid overstimulating or even minor stimulation of the ovaries. But typically, patients are doing 3 rounds of ovulation meds, just some random dose, not even knowing mm-hmm. if they need it. They may be ovulatory. Then 3 rounds of IUI, then 3 rounds of IVF. And then if it fails, oh, do more IVF.
Right.
So there's some fertility doctors that people have messaged me where they do look for endometriosis and treat it. Some REIs do. I'm very impressed when they do. There are definitely some exceptional ones that are very good surgeons. Now, the problem with REI, as far as endometriosis is concerned, from that perspective, is that most of them admit that they haven't had enough surgical training. Their focus mm-hmm. is IVF. So you have to think about it as, I'm going to this doctor, their main specialty is IVF. They have some knowledge of endometriosis. For me, I frequently look in these pelvises of women going through infertility, and I'll even repeat surgeries on patients I've done surgery on if they haven't conceived in 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel like, you know, we've gotten ovulation and all these other, we don't see any major obstacles. I will offer a second look to potentially see if there are adhesions or endometriosis. And so, you know, I've really been able to, through this experience and having a lot of continuity of care of patients, really it helped me understand the disease and what to expect in patients. Mm-hmm. And obviously it varies depending on the patient. But REIs, they don't typically have that continuity. They don't really have training in tubal corrective surgery right. almost at all. Most mm-hmm. of them, I think, I mean, it's an exception if they do. And so you have to think about the bias of, and I tell patients this, I said, I am a surgeon. That is my bias.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do this procedure. So I just want to let you know and be transparent that when you walk in my clinic, I'm going to probably think of endometriosis more than others.
Right.
And so, and that's my tool. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to another doctor, just think about what tools they have. It's going to lead their bias into their treatment. Mm-hmm. And so it's important when you know what treatments are and what are the causes of infertility, you're empowered to understand, okay, not only what do I need, but why is this doctor offering this?
Right.
And so it just helps with that informed consent process.
Absolutely. Can you explain what an REI is for those who maybe don't know what that is?
Yeah, so it's a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist. So they have an additional board certification. They do a fellowship in infertility. With the advent of Clomid in the 60s and IVF in the 70s, REI really, that subspecialty really changed its focus to those type of procedures and IUI, which is actually from the 17th century. Instead of before that time, before the 1960s, they were really endocrinologists looking at root cause. They were more looking for those types of things. And when these technologies came about, like Clomid, they thought, oh, there's a quick pill. It's going to get everyone pregnant. 10, 20 years later, we realized Clomid doesn't have that high success for pregnancy alone. So then after that, though, so then they were doing less surgery when Clomid happened. And then with IVF, that again happened, where they're like, okay, this is the fix. We don't need to put patients through all this surgery. It sounded so great. And it sounded so promising that it would have super high success. Unfortunately, it didn't have high success, especially for women that are older. So women that are infertile tend to be older. And women with endometriosis have lower success rates, especially deep infiltrative. But the problem is, it takes 10, 20 years to see the success.
Right.
And in those decades, skills, surgical skills are lost forever, potentially. And so the art of surgery is pretty rare, especially for tubal surgery and endometriosis surgery, obviously, no. Tubal surgery is even harder, unfortunately, to find surgeons to do that. So that's kind of the evolution. I don't think it's by anyone's fault. I think it was through, oh, this is going to be easier, less invasive, quicker. It gets the outcome we want, right? I mean, it's very appealing because, especially for patients too, and doctors, because it sounds great. You just put the embryo in and you have a baby, right? Well, it's obvious it doesn't work out that way. So yeah, there's a history behind that. And so unfortunately, REI fellowships focus mainly on IVF training. And they do, it depends on the training program. But there was a survey a few years ago, and I think over 50% said, I wish I had more surgical training. So that's, again, I think it speaks to the REI as far as, do they talk about endometriosis? How upfront are they about the different diagnoses? Do they try to avoid IVF? Do they try to do it as last resort? We definitely see those. They're just more rare. The one I trained under, he didn't have a diagnosis. He actually based his treatment on ability to pay. So for me, my experience is biased. It's not great because that definitely was not a good introduction to me as to his approach.
It's interesting how history affects the trajectory of a disease.
The pill was around the same time in the 60s, right? So women are feeling better on the pill. It must stop the progression.
Right. Of course, it's what they, you know, it's an easy solution. It's all so easy.
So I think all of that came together. It's definitely appealing. It's much quicker. We all, physicians and patients alike, we love quick fixes. Yep. And so it seemed that way. And I mean, that's the hard part about what I do, is that it takes time. There's no quick fix involved. It's definitely more of an investment in time. So that can be really hard. You know, and it's not for everyone. Not everyone wants that.
But for those who have struggled for many years and have done what they thought were all the right steps, this is definitely a good step to consider as well. So there's another resource to put into your tool belt in navigating this journey. It's so intriguing to find this out because this is all stuff that, you know, I had very little knowledge on anything that you do prior to really doing my research. And being introduced to you through via the Instagram. And if you want to follow more, where can people follow you on Instagram?
My handle is Napro Fertility Surgeon.
There you go.
Or you find my name, I'm sure it's on there too, Naomi Whitaker.
Yep. So is there anything else that you would find pertinent for listeners to hear that would be beneficial for them in this journey?
You know, finding someone who won't ever give up. Like, for my patients, we're going to keep looking, obviously within reason. There is a time and a place where we get to a point where mentally they're done. And then sometimes they just want permission to be done. They've been doing this for 5+ years. Mm-hmm. And they want someone to tell them they're not giving up, but that it's okay. They covered all the bases and then they're at peace, which is amazing. To get to that, you know, no one can ever guarantee you a baby, but to be able to feel like you had a thorough workup, you had support, and you found all the answers and you're healthier. And then to close on that chapter, you know, think about the end. Hopefully, obviously we want a baby and that is great. And it doesn't heal the pain of infertility, but that's the best outcome we would want. But what happens, kind of worst case scenario, after working with the provider, hopefully you at least got answers and healing and peace when you went look back. Because a lot of closing the infertility chapter is, which people don't talk about, because no one wants to talk about, but there is a time sometimes when we close trying for that biological baby. But what women want to know when they close that chapter is they are going to have peace. They're going to have peace in the moment knowing we tried so hard to cover all our bases. We did everything within reason as far as, you know, excision. Some people don't want excision, right? But whatever it is within reason for them. And they can look back in 5-10 years and say, you know, we worked hard and wow, what a journey that was. But they have a sense of peace. I think that's what people look for when they're closing that chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point to make, because I think a lot of us, if we're faced with that, it is a really hard thing to kind of find peace with. But if you know that you've done everything that you possibly can with a really good provider, I think there is a sense of peace there. Not to say that there's not grieving that happens, because I think that's always going to be the case. But I do think to have peace knowing that you did your absolute best to fulfill that dream and that desire. Dr. Whitaker, thank you so much for joining me today and just taking the time.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is not an easy topic to talk about, and you make it so much easier to highlight this in a way that gives good information. So thank you so much for taking the time to do that.
Yeah, so happy to help. Definitely very close to my heart, this issue. So thank you for talking about it.
Absolutely. And until next time, everyone, continue advocating for you and for those that you love.